So where once public health academics and practitioners shunned research on human rights, the expansive development of international human rights law has led to a rapidly expanding stream of analyses on the implementation of human rights for global health. Good morning, everyone. My name is Benjamin Meyer. I'm an associate professor of global health policy at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And more importantly to this conversation, I am the chair of the brand new APHA Human Rights Forum, launched just last night. Welcome to our very first session, and it is exciting to focus on what we are trying to do here, which is to mainstream human rights in global health. Our session, or our forum, was unanimously approved this summer by the executive board, creating a home for us to advance universal human rights discourses in public health practice. Human rights will be crucial to mainstreaming these valuable discourses in public health. And I'm delighted to introduce and moderate our very first session on human rights research for public health promotion. Human rights research is crucial to this mainstreaming effort. I'm delighted to introduce and moderate this first panel, in which I hope to briefly describe, at least initially, the importance of human rights to public health promotion, and then to introduce the panelists who are going to help us in evaluating the role of both qualitative and quantitative research methods in studying human rights implementation. Health and human rights for many of us has become an independent field over the last 30 years, finding broad acceptance and proving highly influential in both national and global contexts. By signing international human rights treaties, national governments acknowledge their legal obligations to realize the rights of their peoples in public health practice. However, we've begun to see how signing a treaty, ratifying a treaty alone, has almost no effect on public health practice. Shockingly, signing a treaty does not magically make people healthier. And so the ratification of human rights treaties by national governments is seen as only the first step in the effective realization of human rights for public health. To realize rights, states need to implement these obligations under national policy, actions in their public health programming, and results in people's lives. If governments are doing something to implement human rights, though, we need to figure out what that is. We need research. And there's a research imperative to understand the steps that national governments are taking in order to implement their international human rights obligations. And so the panelists here are going to provide us with a survey of the approaches that are being taken to study human rights implementation, elucidating various quantitative and qualitative research efforts to study the impact of international human rights treaty bodies, national judicial challenges, civil society efforts to employ human rights to advance public health. We'll begin with Brian Citro, who's going to talk about the Global Health and Human Rights Database as a unique tool to study the influence of law on public health. Professor Citro is here at the University of Chicago School of Law, where he's a clinical lecturer in law and associate director of the International Human Rights Clinic and director of the project Developing a Rights-Based Approach to TB. Prior to this, he worked in New Delhi as a senior research officer to the UN Special Rapporteur on the human right to the highest attainable standard of health, and worked for the Lawyers Collective, wherein he led the effort to develop a global health and human rights database. We'll then hear from Kumanan Rasanathan on the crucial role of evidence to increase uptake and utilization of human rights-based approaches in public health practice. Dr. Rasanathan is a practitioner and a physician. We will not hold it against him in either regard. He's a senior health specialist for UNICEF in New York. He leads UNICEF's work on health and human rights, its work on implementing the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals, its work on social determinants of child health, on district health system strengthening, and integrating community management policy, universal health coverage, and implementation research. Following Dr. Rasanathan, we'll go a little bit off program. We are delighted to add to our conversation Scott Burris, who's going to be speaking about monitoring human rights law for evaluation and diffusion. Professor Burris is a professor at Temple Law School and Temple School of Public Health. Thank you for the bus ride on the way over here, by the way. Seminal to improving public health through public health law, he directs the Center for Health Law, Policy, and Practice and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's program on research on policy and law. And then we will end the conversation with Jody Hyman, speaking on human rights agreements, how taking them seriously could transform population health. Dr. Hyman is the Dean and Distinguished Professor of Epidemiology at UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health. She's the Distinguished Professor of Public Health Policy at the Luskin School of Public Affairs, and she is a Distinguished Professor of Medicine at the David Geffen School of Medicine. She's worked with government leaders in North America, Europe, Africa, and Latin America, and various international organizations, including the World Health Organization, the International Labor Organization, the World Economic Forum, UNICEF, and UNESCO to advance public policies for global health. With these panelists really seeking to come together and help us to understand the role of accountability mechanisms as a basis for assuring implementation efforts for human rights and public health, I hope that a comparison of these research methods, both during the presentations and during the conversation afterwards, will help us to think through how academic research can support public health practice to realize the rights to the highest attainable standard of health, to help us to conceptualize the role and the necessity of research in making this highest attainable standard of health a reality. Each presenter will speak for 12 to 15 minutes, and I hope this will leave time for questions both across the panelists and with everyone here. So thank you again for coming to our very first session of the Human Rights Forum. We'll pass around a sign-up sheet so that if you want more information about the forum, we can send it to you. And I hope we have a wonderful conversation, starting Professor Citro.
Thank you, Ben. Good morning. So I'm very happy to be here, the start of the Health and Human Rights Forum. And I'm also really happy to talk with you about the database today. So this is something I spent a lot of time working on a few years ago, and I think it fits perfectly into this session, which I think is a good idea to promote research towards the end of promoting health and human rights, or kind of understanding the relationship more fully. So I'll have a few slides that kind of describe the background and the purpose and the contents of the database, and then I'll take some time and actually kind of show you what it looks like online and how to use it. My goal is really just to familiarize you with what the database is, and to suggest some of the, or explain some of the reasons why it exists, and then we can take some questions afterwards. So the Global Health and Human Rights Database is essentially a project of the Lawyers Collective and the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health at Georgetown. So the Lawyers Collective, how many of you are familiar with the Lawyers Collective, if anyone? Okay. How many lawyers are in the room, by the way? Okay. That's good. I'm usually in rooms full of many more lawyers. Company. So the Lawyers Collective is a NGO in India, in Delhi and Mumbai. They have two divisions. One is the Women's Rights Division, works on women's rights issues. The other is the HIV/AIDS Unit, which has really now become more kind of a health and human rights kind of promoting division of the organization, does advocacy and also litigation. The O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law, is anyone familiar with the O'Neill Institute? Okay. So it's kind of, I think, a pretty unique institute at Georgetown University and associated with the law school as well, that's really focused on research and also work in the area of health, not just health and human rights, but they do work in health and human rights as well. So these are the two kind of primary institutions that had the idea to start and then have kind of developed and maintained the database. But what's really, I think, unique about this is that it's really a global network of much more than, I think it's closer to 200 now, civil society organizations, individual partners, and academic institutions that have helped develop the database. And the idea is that it should reflect the kind of research of all these organizations, and it should, if we want to actually get to all the different domestic jurisdictions, then we need people who are working in those jurisdictions to provide us with content. The funding comes primarily from Levi Strauss Foundation and the Ford Foundation. So what's the purpose? So essentially, the database is a free, searchable online resource. It's at globalhealthrights.org, and the purpose is pretty simple. It's just to increase access to case law, to legal judgments that involve health and human rights from around the world. So that was the initial idea, and my sense is that it started kind of in a few different parts of the world where people needed access to judgments that they had a sense might have existed, or they needed to do research in jurisdictions that, where they couldn't speak the language or they couldn't access judgments online. And so the idea was, well, why don't we try to aggregate all these judgments in one place so that we have a one-stop shop, and to the extent that we need to translate, we can translate judgments and we can summarize cases, which I'll show you is what we've done. So it's really meant for researchers, for lawyers, for medical professionals, activists, etc. I mean, anybody who's interested either from kind of a research perspective or a practitioner's perspective, interested in understanding or finding case law, legal judgments, that it's really, the database is meant for them. And the focus is on really increasing access in parts of the world where it's more difficult to get access. So developing countries, and that might be because the internet isn't as good. They lack access to Westlaw or LexisNexis or some of these fancy databases that require a pretty hefty payment to access. So this was really the purpose, was to increase access to judgments that involve health and human rights, particularly for people who might not otherwise have access. So the contents of the database here is just some numbers, and as I said, this will all become more concrete when I show you the database. There's about 1,300 judgments, so those are opinions from courts, legal judgments. It covers about 92 countries, 16 international and regional courts, including the European Court of Human Rights, the Inter-American Commission, and a variety of international jurisdictions. It's about 36 languages, so there are judgments in 36 different languages. There are 600 judgment summaries, so these are kind of case briefs where we have lawyers who read the judgments and then summarize their content so that you don't have to read the entire judgment to understand what's happening. And we've tried hard to make it the language accessible to non-lawyers. So anybody who's dealt with lawyers know that sometimes the language can be really archaic, so we tried to use plain language to the extent that we can so it's accessible not just to lawyers. So there's 600 summaries of judgments. Almost half of all the judgments have summaries. And then we've commissioned and completed 200 original translations, so meaning translating from another language into English. And there's a 200 official judgment translations where we've gotten these from official sources like the court itself or other sources. The database is also, we've just made it usable in Spanish as well. So in terms of how you navigate and all the language that's on the website itself, it's available in Spanish and English. And the hope is to expand those languages as well. So you can download every judgment as a PDF in multiple languages. And then the judgment summaries that we've written at the Lawyers Collective or at the O'Neill Institute are also available, downloadable as PDFs. And there's two other parts of the database. There's a National Constitutions database and an International Instruments database. So there are 76 constitutions and 147 instruments that are searchable as well. This is kind of meant to kind of support the research aspect. When you're searching for case law, you also have access to the constitutions and international documents. So very briefly, I'll just show you, I'll just kind of mention some of the ways we've designed the database to be used, and then I can go online and show you exactly how it's actually used. So I think we realize initially that the only way this will be useful is if it's very easy to use and very easy to search. So we actually have a Google search bar at the top. So you I don't know how many of you have worked on websites, but you can essentially rent the Google search bar, and then it trolls your entire site just like Google does on the internet, and then you're searching your website just like you would search the internet. So when you open the website or the database, there's a Google search bar, and you can start typing, and then you have access to all the pages just like you would online. We thought that was the best way. I don't know if you've used Westlaw or LexisNexis. Westlaw is actually, these are the two major legal databases, U.S.-based legal databases that we use kind of as a model, and Westlaw's changed as well, but initially the databases were set up where you had to choose a bunch of parameters before you started searching, which a lot of us felt was a little bit difficult, and I think the way we all use the internet now is just to start typing what we want and see what we get. So that's what we tried to do with the database. There's an interactive map, which you'll see, that shows the number of judgments we have from each country, and we've developed a list of health topics and human rights, and then we've tagged all the cases with these health topics and human rights. So you really see an intersection of health and human rights in the way that we've categorized things. There's drop-down menus, there's an advanced search, and there's hundreds of tags as well, and you can filter the search results. So let me just give you an example then of how the database looks. So this is the home page. This is the Google search bar that I mentioned. Here's the interactive map. So if I go to the United States, you can see we have this many judgments from the US, this many from Russia, etc. These are the drop-down menus. So if I want to see, for instance, all the judgments in Europe, I would click here. These are the regional bodies, international bodies. You can also filter the map. Let me just refresh this. So if I want to see all the countries that have judgments involving disability, involving HIV. I click, and then the map will. So these are then all the judgments involving HIV. So there's 26 judgments in the United States involving HIV. There's 17 from India. If I want to look at human rights, I can say freedom from discrimination. So these are all the countries that have judgments involving freedom from discrimination. So maybe I want to go to the UK and look. There's 26 judgments. I can clear the map and start over. So let me give an example then. Somebody name a health topic or a health issue.
Incarceration.
Okay, if we have that one. Yes, there we go. And so then what you get here is like a Google search results page, just as you would if you were searching online. And this has gotten better and better over time, so the first result is actually what we would want it to be. This will be a list of all the cases that have been tagged with incarceration. So this is then kind of our search results page that we designed. So you see there's 100 judgments that involve incarceration, and you can see here's the tag for incarceration. So I'll just zoom down so you can see what these look like. This we really took from Westlaw, so you can see the country, the year, the court that it took place in, the citation, here's the health topic, the human rights that are involved, and then here you'll see the facts. So this is kind of the beginning of the summary. So you get a sense of what the case is before you look any further, and you can download the judgment from here. But if you click on the title, then you go to what we call the summary page. So here you have more detailed information. Here's the facts of the case, the decision and reasoning, and then here are some excerpts from the decision. So from this page, if I want to, I can download the judgment, and it comes up as a PDF. I can also view the summary as a full summary, and if I want to print it, I can click on print right there. I can also download the summary as a PDF. So in the last couple of minutes, I'll just show you a couple other ways to search. So if I want, for instance, to research cases from India, I click on India, and it takes me right to the page where all the Indian cases are. And I can also filter the results. So if I want to just see cases in India that involve chronic NCDs, click on that. And so there's 25 judgments from India that involve NCDs and chronic diseases. I can use the advanced search. by region, by body, by health topic, by human right, by year, etc. So just quickly, I'll show you the National Constitutions Database, the international instrument. So here we have 140 instruments, which you can sort by year of adoption, you can sort by region. So if I want to just see international instruments in Africa, I say we have six in the database. When I click on it, I have access to an abridged version, and I can download the entire version here. So to sum up, this what we really hope we're doing here is increasing access to case law primarily, but also to constitutions and international instruments that involve health and human rights. And it's really a curated database. We worked hard to define the scope to focus on certain health topics, a wide range of health topics, and a wide range of human rights. And then we've categorized all the judgments and tried to make them really as searchable and as easy to find as possible. So that's essentially it, and I look forward to questions when we're done. Thank you.
This is a great collection of approaches, which is very encouraging. I think one of the challenges we're facing, I work on the Commission on the Determinants of Health, and you look at, and we're doing some work on social determinants of child health, and I think we really need to link the work on social determinants of health and the work on human rights much more strongly. And I know many people have advocated that, but they're still relatively separate communities, and that's a challenge. But one of the things is that the data we want is, so we can get evidence on, we're getting an evidence of the range of laws we have, right? And we have some understanding of what you need to make the laws work, right? Which is a problem. And we can even do associations on between policies and health outcomes. I think this is very useful. If you look at in health, though, what the way evidence is normally used, I mean, I used to work on vaccine clinical trials, which are these very sort of specialized things, and people say, well, you know, you do this, and this results in an X percent improvement in health, or X numbers of lives, and we do it ourselves, we have a life save tool, we put in interventions, you improve coverage of those services. What we've been saying, there's a new global strategy on women's, children, and adolescents' health, and we're saying we need to take a multi-sectoral approach. And the tagline I've been saying is that in the health sector, when we talk about children's child mortality, we need to care as much about the coverage of quality education for families and girls as we care about the coverage of immunization rates, right? But the challenge we have when we say that is that our immunization for education, which is improving, is generally at the level of modeling and association data. And that, whereas our evidence for immunization, right, is actually often from trials and they're saying, well, these kids got immunization, these kids. And it's very difficult to have more data beyond the associated data. Fine to have the modeling data, but then we need to frame that in a way that decision makers and policy makers and even health workers and community understand the theory of change and understand, well, what are the processes they need to monitor to get that improvement, right? So to really link, well, you pass a law, what are all the steps that lead to a better health outcome? Right, and I understand from a human rights point of view, it's not just about health outcomes, it's also about processes. But I think unless we can make that case, it's hard to persuade the decision makers about the importance of these broad range of policies and measures in different sectors. And it's hard for people to understand how they must take more sort of cognizance of human rights law and human rights approaches.
So let me just take that on, both agree and disagree, to spice up the panel a little bit. The part I agree with is we shouldn't just look at associations. We should actually look at impact. The part I disagree with is that we haven't done it. In fact, the data I showed you, subject to our time constraint, is not associational data. It's the closest to causal modeling and structural models. It's longitudinal data, so what happens when you follow dozens of countries, you look at the countries that increased a policy and those that didn't. The only thing that it's not is a randomized controlled trial. I promise you we will never get a randomized controlled trial on the constitutional right to health. There is no constitution that can give it to half and not to half, and there's nobody who is going to legally randomize and say, okay, on this half, you all can marry at 15, And on this app, you can marry at 18. But this is the next best thing, which is looking at what happens when the countries pass it, and it's extremely rigorous data. You find things don't work. You find things that do work. So I agree, that is where we should be going. We need to learn from it. But I actually think we're already there. I just think we have to all put together the resources and the tools to make this happen.
I just want to pile on that. Every time a country changes law, you're having a natural experiment. You have multiple countries changing their laws and changing them with different, slightly different cut points, different ages. You end up having just hundreds or thousands of points of comparison. So that the robustness for causal inference is really high if you have the outcomes and the mediating data, which is really a problem sometimes, especially internationally. But it all points to the fact that, and I should just say the last sort of piece on this foundation, remember, we know that seatbelts work because of research like this. We know the child safety. We know the alcohol taxes work because of stuff like that. I mean, a lot of what we do in public health and public health is all actually evaluated this way, and we can tell it from the story of policymakers. But, we looked at all the NIH grants in the last 30 years, and there are only around 500 where they're really actually funding serious policy. And think about that. We spend more money, finding out whether the difference between a 10-minute and a 5-minute motivational interview on a cell phone, every year, then will influence obesity than we do on these treatments that we put to hundreds of millions of people. And partly it's this bias towards the randomized controlled trial. We'd rather fund a randomized controlled trial of triviality than fund quasi-experimental study or something that's profoundly important in reaching millions. And we have a fight about that, I think, to really get greater support.
I think we're on the same side, and the challenge is, I always see myself as someone who's a lot of social determinants of human rights, is how do we engage the sort of mainstream of practice. And I do agree that we are definitely improving, and we've just commissioned a systematic review looking at intervention and the impact on child health and agriculture and education and nutrition and water sanitation and the world environment. It was actually striking, though, the paucity of studies that did look at intervention. Right? And I'm sure it's about
it. And I think the lack of funding towards it, right.
But I think the concern is, right, is that absolutely. I mean, randomized control trials, I worked on randomized control trials for 3 years, do not describe reality either, and we fetishize them, and we need to move beyond that and look at different types of data. But at the same time, when we use associational data, we also need to address the policy implementation gap, right? Like, we don't assess the efficacy of effectiveness of immunization because you passed a law or a policy that says all children should be immunized, right? We actually look at how many children get immunized and what is the impact. Right. Whereas, so in the same way, I think we need to bridge, so take education for example. We need to say, well, yes, you can pass a law or a policy for university education, but you're not looking at, well, does that mean children actually get education? What's the policy of that education? And we need to link actual delivery services in other sectors to help outcomes rather than just policy.
There are different views on this, but I know we want to hear from
the audience. I do want to hear from the audience. Let me give Brian a chance to just quickly answer that first question, and then I hope to open it up in the last 10 minutes.
Yeah, so just a very quick point. Not an example of something. Did some research on sex selection in India, China, and also in the United States. And one of the, maybe an interesting example of one way, working with economists, that we tried to isolate the impact of policy was through a difference analysis. And this gets close
that's
to
what these are.
Yeah, so we looked at Illinois, which had a policy in 1984, and then we compared it to the surrounding states that had a policy to determine that. We controlled for a lot of different things about the population of women who were in votes in the groups of states. we got some interesting results, and it turned out we didn't see an impact on sex ratio, so we thought the policy probably didn't have an impact. And then to the implementation point, though, doing research in India, looking at what the PCPNDT Act, which makes it illegal to communicate the sex of the fetus to a woman. You can't do that. It's a violation of law. It's been in effect for a long time. There's been a lot of initiatives to implement it in different states, at the state level, but it's almost impossible to link or it's the first step for passing a law and determining whether it had an impact on stopping the practice of sex selection is two totally different questions. So I agree that implementation is key. Again, we did a difference in difference analysis of a state in India, neighboring state, and found it had some impact. But for us, and having doing the research in India, you realize that the implementation side is massive, and also it's completely diverse across a country like India, just like it would be in the United States. So getting to that implementation part of it is often most difficult.
Okay, so given the time, I'm going to collect a few questions, and then I'm going to turn it back to the panelists, and we'll begin on this side.
I mean, you guys alluded to this. You start with the international conventions, you get the laws of the country, you get maybe the policies of the country, and you know, you get in even when you have access. What concerns me, and you know, is when, and you said, oh, how human rights-based approach that providers can help, you know, use it to improve their services. But I work a lot in maternal health, and a widespread problem in Africa, and I think the world in developing countries, is actual human rights abuse by the providers themselves. So that we know that women in labor are verbally and physically abused on a regular basis, to the level of, from a legal basis, would probably be considered assault, proper assault, at least malpractice. But clearly no one wants to go in and start arresting midwives. And so how can we use all the great laws in the world, now that has the most progressive constitution, this happens every day in every hospital in South Africa. How do we research and understand how we can use a human rights-based approach to change the culture of providers at a service level?
Okay. There was a question over here.
My question is, how much the power of the judge of international criminal rights court the judge if a Chinese citizen wins the criminal rights judge against the Chinese government, and how he can influence the Chinese government to respect his criminal rights is a threat to other countries. And this is my question. The other question is, international human rights call, how we can use the platform to really improve the human rights for the countries the government doesn't really care about it.
Perfect. And there was a question in the back.
This is actually related a lot to the first question, and it's primarily for Dr. Ramadan. I was interested in when you're talking about sort of the frontline health workers, and that one of the reasons they're not utilizing the human rights based approach is that their own maybe personal moral approach comes from a different epistemology. And what are some of the methods that you've seen for drawing connections between, you know, those sort of personal approaches, whether they're more contextual or relational or communitarian, to a rights based approach to their work, and how can you help draw connections between that for the workers?
And then we'll just take one final question, and then I'll ask all of the speakers to sort of sum up their answers and give some final remarks.
And then building on that, can you compare and contrast a human rights-based approach and a public health approach?
Okay. Well, we'll go in the order that the presentations were given and begin with Brian.
That's a lot of questions. I think the easiest one for me to answer, or I don't know if I'll do as good a job as that, panel, but the last question very quickly. In my mind, as a lawyer, I think one of the major differences between a public health approach and a human rights approach is the human rights approach focuses on the health of individuals and tries to articulate kind of individual rights that have both normative kind of principle legal foundations, but, and to the kind of purpose of this panel, also can be justified, I think, through instrumental reasons, in the sense that they result in better health outcomes. But that's partly what we're trying to prove here today, or to promote research toward. I think on the largest level, the difference would be that if you're focused on population health, you might be willing to, for instance, violate the right to informed consent, or maybe discrimination to get to some sort of utilitarian, utilitarian end of better health for the population. Human rights approach would say you shouldn't do that because it's in principle wrong, and that at the end of the day you're going to get more sustainability and cooperation if you don't, if you respect and protect its rights. For the lack of, because we don't have a lot of time, let's move on to the other questions.
Yeah, go ahead.
I want to ask a different question because I can talk for a little bit later. I think on the public health versus human rights approach, or the link, I think there's a lot of great articles, especially a Brooklyn and colleagues did an article about 10 years ago, which I recommend to you. And there's a special issue of health and human rights on social determinants, which I think teased out many of those things, which again, I think is very useful with links to social differences. I think the issue, the one sort of link questions on how does it, someone in China, or how does you link in the frontline health worker, for me, and this is my bias, but I say this as someone who works at the global level currently, I think we need much less focus on the global level and much more focus on the national and stuff, and particularly the sub-national level. And of course the global instruments are important, but every country's context is very, that's what determines what policies, what norms, how things are implemented. And I think we must need much more of a focus in all of our work, not just in human rights, at that level. Because for me, for example, last week, listening to sort of both health workers, district managers talk about how they were using these scorecards, they use a traffic light, red, green, yellow, and they select indicators for different services, and then they collate the data, and they use it at community level, but they use it to influence national decision makers. I think the main thing is, I think what Jody was talking about is actually thinking about individual countries' context, not imposing a priori framework on them and saying, thou will do this. And thinking then, and I don't care if people call it social determinants or human rights or public health, it's really thinking what works for people, how do they describe it, and saying, well, here are some tools, here are some methods, here are some things, here are some cases and experience decisions that might help you. I think sometimes we say, well, everyone needs to recite the AAAQ, or everyone needs to know the framework of the conceptual framework of the social determinants of health, or, you know, health systems, we have universal health coverage, resilient health systems, and we spin out all these global frameworks and national frameworks. And I think it's more saying, well, in the end, I think what you want on the right to health is what's important, right? People want people to have the opportunity, they want to have access to health services, they want the determinants. And listening to people, what they value and where they're going. And that doesn't mean just licensing whatever happens, because there are violations of people's individual context that we shouldn't be sanctioning. But I think that's where you can go, and when you talk to people, you can listen to them and say, well, you might be able to use this tool or this method, and that might not.
Yeah, that would still be what you say, that it's so true. Because I just want to endorse it. I've been at this for 30 years. I don't care about the difference between health and human rights and public health, what public health law and all that. I care if we get the right answer, we get things done right. And I think, in a way, we've retarded ourselves by having this ongoing cultural, philosophical battle at this very high level, whereas meanwhile the real answers are playing out in places. And this is my one, I just want to respond to this, what you said about when we were still talking about the research and that's the point. I think that this is, the real battle is the battle for a kind of intellectual infrastructure and resource infrastructure for doing this work. Because you have to start somewhere. It's true that if you just have the law in the books, then you don't know what is happening to implementation. And for years, that was justification for not bothering to collect the law in the books. So first, you start at the beginning, you collect what's supposed to happen. Then you figure out, you start to use research, qualitative research, to figure out what are we supposed to, what should we observe if that's going to happen? What should we be able to see in a community if that thing is really happening? We can tell, how do we measure that? And then we invest in measuring that. And then we see, oh, look at the things that are supposed to happen aren't happening. So you keep building and building and building, and 10 years, 15 years, you're serious about it, you actually get somewhere, as opposed to just talking about it again and again and again and being there.
So I think we're ending with actually a remarkable amount of consensus on many of the issues. So first on the laws and the implementation. Just like when you do a randomized clinical trial, you don't say, okay, I'm just going to study the people who took the medicine. You say, I'm just studying the people who we gave it to. Well, I actually think of the laws, we have to know what the laws are, because they won't won't be perfectly implemented. They're not perfectly implemented in any country, so we need to know, do they work, just to have them. Once we do, we absolutely have to look at implementation, because we have to understand why are they working some places and not others, how are they working better. On the question of countries and reaching countries, the piece I want to say is, we found the comparative data matters. So we've had visits from Chinese government leaders, Ghanaian government leaders, U.S. government leaders. They want to know how competitor countries are doing. They want to know the outcomes for health. They want to know the outcomes for the economy. So being able to link these to outcome data, it matters and it helps. The last note I want to make is about the human rights agreements. I completely agree. We have to go to where people start, and people start this discussion in a lot of different ways. A lot of us actually think human rights are an embedded part of public health. And when our students graduate at UCLA, actually part of what part of what you pledge has a human rights basis. I think at Harvard, where I taught previously, you get the Universal Declaration. So many of us think it's embedded, but we can all speak about these issues differently. What the human rights agreements do is they show a remarkable level of global investment and commitment to these common principles. And that's a great starting point when it's helpful, and when other languages more helpful to find that common space, we show that.
So we began with a conundrum that ratifying a treaty does not magically make people healthier. And so we need to think about this process, everything that happens after countries ratify treaties. And we've looked at a wide range of different steps along the way, whether it's the laws, whether it's the litigation, whether it's the practice, whether it's the outcomes for people's lives. What we're seeing here is that in order to look at this process, to know that human rights are a reality in people's lives, we need human rights research. And we've seen a wide range of examples of how coding human rights data can provide us with a sense of how implementation is taking place and the ways in which human rights are a reality across different countries so that we can begin to appreciate how universal human rights can be a reality for people's lives all over the world. So this was the first panel of our brand new Human Rights Forum at APHA. Please join me in thanking the wonderful speakers.